part of his political project here is just to say, look, we're only accountable to each other. There's no other authority save the authority of human beings coming together and agreeing about something.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas. Produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is the very first episode of Damn the Absolute. We're joining an already ongoing conversation in what I hope will be an edifying approach to philosophy, ideas, and ultimately lead to a little bit more human flourishing in the world. At Damn the Absolute, I will be interviewing a wide range of people I believe either offer up some ideas worth considering or provide a fruitful challenge to some of the prevailing notions that we have about what it means to relate to ideas. I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Today, I'm speaking with Adrian Rutt, a philosophy professor in Cleveland, Ohio. He is president of the Western Reserve Philosophical Society, a local group that engages the larger community in important conversations across philosophy and politics. Adrian is also an editor for Liberal Currents, an online publication defending liberal principles and institutions, which makes him a perfect fit for walking us through today's philosopher, and that is Richard Rorty. We'll be exploring the political thought of this iconoclastic philosopher, specifically looking at his 1998 book, Achieving Our Country, Leftist Thought in 20th Century America. Well, Adrian, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, likewise. It's we've been connected on Twitter for quite some while, and it's nice to put a voice to some ideas that I've seen you putting out there. So welcome.
Yeah, thanks. I that's primarily where we meet all the kind of pragmatists coming out of the woodwork, you know, on Twitter, which is actually nice to see.
We're over here at Damn the Absolute. We have a sympathy for fallibilism. So I'd like to start out with a question for you is, what is a viewpoint you've held in adulthood that you were quite certain would probably never change that has shifted dramatically for you?
Oh, wow. What has shifted dramatically for me? I would say, if we're talking about even early adulthood, I was, and this is actually kind of interesting because it does connect up with the subject today, but I was actually pretty militantly atheist at one point. And I know other people probably can sympathize with this point of view. And I think I tempered that significantly, partly from running into people who were religious. And I realized, you know, like a lot of things, oh, that's not the kind of religion that these, you know, the new atheists or the militant atheists are talking about. And they have a little more coherency to their worldviews. And it's not just all kind of like this looking for fallacies and logic. And life's a little brighter than that. So I'd say that is maybe one of the biggest ones, biggest turns I have. Off the top of my head, I'm trying to think of something else. I think, and this will become clear, another one I'd probably have is, and this is maybe a little bit ironic, have significantly downplayed the uses of philosophy in some senses. And I know there's a lot there, and that's a pretty pregnant assertion, but and probably radical, and it probably makes people angry. But as people know, if people know anything about Rorty, hopefully after this conversation, they will. They'll see where that's coming from. But I think I've definitely adjusted my views on what philosophy can accomplish and kind of narrowed it a little bit from when I first started into philosophy, when I thought it was kind of the queen of all the disciplines. And we get to determine, or we philosophers get to determine who's right and who's wrong. And we're holding the keys of the kingdom. But I've significantly changed my views on that. So yeah, I guess those would be two.
Absolutely. I think those are two very strong. The first one's definitely a common one I've encountered in a lot of circles. The second point is definitely fits in quite well with the work of Rorty. And I think there is a lot of appeal for a lot of people in philosophy of being able to say, oh, if I go into philosophy, I can then become the arbiter of which is actually true and not, and sort of being that judge to all the other disciplines, which Rorty obviously would disagree with.
Yeah.
We'll unpack that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So diving in here, right into political philosophy of Rorty, primarily we're looking at Achieving Our Country, which is actually, I think, a very accessible read for a lot of people. And it's seen a resurgence the last few years, especially given some of the prophetic or seemingly prophetic analysis that Rorty offered writing this 20 years ago, especially with the 2016 election. We can touch on that a little bit later, but I want to start out with a quote from Achieving Our Country, which is the same quote that you start out with your recent essay for Liberal Currents, as well as the first paragraph in the book. Rorty says, "National pride is to countries what self-respect is to individuals, a necessary condition for self-improvement. Too much national pride can produce bellicosity and imperialism, just as excessive self-respect can produce arrogance. But just as too little self-respect makes it difficult for a person to display moral courage, so insufficient national pride makes energetic and effective debate about national policy unlikely." Can you unpack this a little bit for us?
Yeah, that's quite a bomb drop he has right there at the beginning of the book. And it's, I think, it quite literally the first paragraph you just read of the book. And that is honestly just sums up what he's going. He's just going to spend Achieving Our Country unpacking pretty much that claim, which is just such a nice little quotable paragraph there, too. Essentially, what he's getting at here, and I'm sure we'll dive into kind of some follow down different strands here and different threads, but he sees a theme of the current left, or he's going to kind of split the left into two time periods in this book and say there's kind of this pre-60s left and a post-60s left. Post-60s left kind of is comes out of the Vietnam War era and the Watergate. And he thinks that this post-60s left really becomes too pessimistic and sees America or the United States as nothing but kind of a long train of abuses and atrocities against minorities, which in some cases it's, or not in some cases, that's a hard history to deny in any serious sense. But he says the political implications of just giving in to kind of your pessimism is to sort of just sit back and not be active in politics anymore. And so basically the point is, if you don't think your country is worth saving or has nothing good to say for it, why would you be involved in politics at all? And so he sees this, what he calls, again, the cultural left really removing themselves from politics more so and more so after this time, after saying, okay, look, we're getting ourselves involved in foreign wars. We have 60,000 of our sons and daughters dying. Watergate produced a cynicism in the electorate that was unknown until then. And just scandal after scandal. I mean, this is when media is on the rise. So you're hearing more and more about this stuff, and media is fracturing in the 80s and into the 90s. There's no more monopolies. So it's just hard to not see this stuff. And it's hard, frankly, not to be cynical about it all. And so he thinks they've gone too far in that direction, but he does acknowledge that this is a tricky balance. And that's kind of what he uses that analogy of self-respect and wanting to improve yourself. He thinks having too much self-respect and being too prideful, you know, leads in the opposite direction. And these loosely do, I mean, I don't think this is too controversial. Obviously these loosely map on to kind of the right and left, right, in this country. Is the right is kind of conveniently has justifications and stories to tell that don't put those atrocities out in front. And so they tell a story about hope and freedom and liberty and land of freedom, right? And all that kind of stuff. And that sort of excessive pride without actually realizing the darker sides of that story leads to, you know, hey, we need to export this, you know, we need to export this liberalism and democracy and our ideals and impose it on other people. And if you come here, you got to check your culture at the door and you got to speak English. That sort of stuff kind of leads, is what, you know, excessive self-respect kind of leads to. So I think that's, in a nutshell, sorry, I know that was kind of a long answer, in a nutshell, what he was getting at with that. But again, he spends kind of the entire book trying to unpack that claim.
Yeah, so he's talking here about this national pride, I hear you, of the different stories, the what seems to map closely with the left and the right. And we'll get to what he means by the cultural left and this reformist left, those two different periods of leftism in American thought. But I would like to talk a little bit more of this notion of national pride. What are the things that Americans can take pride in as we look at our history? You've already mentioned some of these atrocities, which absolutely I think we should be paying attention to, things such as slavery, the social injustices. You can go on. But what are the things that Rorty would probably want Americans to be proud of?
Yeah, I mean, this is tricky. This is so tricky. And I've honestly, and what I love about reading Rorty still is how much he makes me think about these things, how much I really just cannot come down with like a very firm grasp of all the time what he's kind of referring to. But to put it plainly, I mean, he's just saying, and this is where it gets tricky, is because he's saying, look, let's continue to, you know, honor Lincoln, let's continue to look at the small activists during the labor movement in the early half of the 20th century and what they did. And I'm just fighting and fighting and just tooth and nail on the ground to, you know, for better working conditions, shorter work weeks, getting children out of the shops when they're 8 years old, and civil rights. There's a certain story of the civil rights, even though it's kind of an optimistic one. It's just fighting the people every day, just hanging on to hope, thinking that they can change this country. I mean, that's ultimately the crux of his argument, right? Is that we can look to people who didn't give up on America. And, you know, Lincoln's a perfect example. He was never going to see things get totally better. He was never going to see utopia. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're never going to see utopia. But part of Rorty's point is that's really beside the point. We should still aim to bring about justice and equality, even though if we're not going to see it, and we shouldn't give up hope. And so there's stories of millions of activists doing the work. And I think that's what he wants us to take pride in, truthfully. And I don't think he's asking us to ignore those atrocities either. But it is weird because he comes kind of closely, he kind of slides towards the right end of the spectrum here, because mm-hmm. that's sort of the story, right? I mean, that's the danger here, is that he does get close to the side where it's like, okay, let's ignore all those atrocities and let's just kind of focus. Yeah, Lincoln, land of freedom, right? And let's, mm-hmm. which clearly it seems like only half, but this connects up larger to his philosophical point that unless you have that pride, unless you looked the good things or the good activists, you're not going to want to change things yourself. And I think one of the best quotes he says in this, or one of the best quotes he has on this subject, and I think it's in Achieving Our Country, almost positive, is when he says, if we look to those who have never made no mistakes, we shall have few heroes, right? So,
great quote.
And that's what he's talking about. I mean, of course, Lincoln wasn't perfect. And of course, those progressives in the early half of the 20th century, you can go on and on about the eugenics and the terrible mm-hmm. ideas they had, right? I mean, this is stuff that's plain and out in the open. We should not follow in their footsteps on that. But nonetheless, if we constantly count out everybody who's made mistakes, then we're not going to have any heroes. We're not going to have anybody to look up to. We're not going to have anybody for, you know, to raise our spirits and get us moving in the right direction again and motivate us to make this a better country.
Yeah, connecting this to some recent controversy, and this is a point you bring up in your recent essay with Liberal Currents. You suggest that the way the New York Times project, the 1619 project, frames the American founding would be deemed regrettable by Rorty. Why would a leftist like Rorty be so critical of such a project?
Yeah, that's a great question. He thought that, I think, and this is where I was kind of going on a limb here, saying he would have thought it regrettable. I tried to use language that wasn't too strong, you know, despise or anything. I think he just would think it was regrettable for all the points that we've been getting into so far, is that this is just the perfect example of someone or of a project that is only going to induce more pessimism and cynicism about our country. And to move our founding date to when the first slaves arrived on our shores, I asked myself, like, what are we accomplishing with this? I mean, that's the question I asked myself. And that's why I ultimately thought that Rorty would have thought this a regrettable project. But like, what does that add to the conversation? Let me put it this way. I think the entire project that they're doing with the journalism and the history that they're bringing to light is fine. But why mm-hmm. take that extra step and say, on top of this, on top of looking at all these things, all these racist policies that still affect us to this day, on top of that, they want to move the founding date. I don't know how you do that, you know, officially, but whatever. Move the founding date.
That's about taken.
Right, exactly. What does that accomplish on the political scene other than, I mean, in my opinion, make one half of this country extremely defensive and angry, right? And possibly even alienate some people that you would have had in your coalition to begin with. So, yeah, I don't know if that answered your question entirely. I think I got too sidetracked by the contemporary stuff. But I just think Rorty says in Achieving Our Country, look, there's nothing our country ultimately adds up to, right? There's no final stamp of either racist or land of hope or anything that you can just finally, you know, put everything that is America into a box and tape it shut and label it and say, yep, ultimately racist. I mean, you see this today with, you know, the conversations people have, you know, America's fundamentally racist. No, it's not. Back and forth. It doesn't, you know, to me, mm-hmm. this conversation is like a conversation about the conversation. Like, I don't know what we're trying to accomplish by fundamentally labeling the country something. There's just too many moving parts. There's too many little histories. There's too many factors that you have to consider. And in the spirit of this podcast, right, damn the absolute, right? William James didn't like the bigness, right? He was always zooming in, right? And I think Rorty, that affects Rorty a lot in this sense. Like, it's too big to consider what America ultimately is. It's too big.
Yeah, you highlight this point, which Rorty says America has a history. It doesn't have a nature. And that's mm-hmm. a point you're making of it. This anti-essentialist notion of there isn't an inherent nature that is America or American. It's best understood as a process, as a history. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, right? What is the point? What are we going to achieve by trying to force someone else to accept a term or a label, such as, like you put it, a racist America, which is not to say American history is not full of racist actions. It absolutely is. And it's a tragic injustice that most of us or many of us are aware of, that we need to maintain an awareness around. But it sounds like what Rorty's trying to say is that work of demystifying this notion of a mythical founding of America as this bastion of perfection, that has been done. What mm-hmm. are we doing now? Right. We don't have to keep doing that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And to add to your point, to put it even, when you say we're essentially this, if you say anything's essentially that, you're basically resigning yourself to not changing, right? What's the end game there? We're essentially this. So are you trying to make us essentially something else? Or, I mean, it's the same thing. You're, you know, it's the kind of the once an addict, always an addict thing. And I think Rorty thought, you know, there's nothing deep down inside ourselves or inside our country that makes us essentially this or that. It's like you said, it's a history. We have a history and it's unfolding constantly. And there's no need to even talk about essentials here really at all. And
Rorty says that there's not a quote, non-mythological or non-ideological way of telling a country's story. Calling a story mythical or ideological would be meaningful only if such stories could be contrasted with an objective story. That seems to be kind of what you're alluding to here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with Rorty, I mean, you have to, obviously, this is his foray into politics. So obviously, there's still some political philosophy here, a lot of political philosophy going on. But obviously, Rorty's philosophy is he's against this kind of idea of objectivity and this kind of disinterested knowing. And this has been a project of, you know, going all the way back to the classical pragmatists through the mid-century. The feminists, I think, were doing a similar thing. But he's basically saying, look, to say that's a, like, it's the classic, like, that's a biased story, or you're prejudiced, or you're telling that with, you know, a certain angle. Of course, we all are, he's basically saying, right? Like, can we stop? Let's put these narratives, let's play them off each other, right? Let's see which one is useful to us in our politics. And I think that's part of what he's saying. And this is like, let's stop arguing about, like, what's, I mean, every single book that's coming out. I mean, this is the one, and this is, goes back to the 1619 project. Like, the here, finally, this is the objective story, you know. And then you have a Sean Hannity will come out with a book, finally, here's the objective story that leftists don't want. You know, they're just lying to you. He just is saying this is just a fruitless exercise. Let's just all admit that we're approaching things from different angles. We're highlighting bits of our history that we want to talk about and putting others on the shelf that we don't. And we're all continually doing this. And politics is playing these narratives off against each other. I know he famously said, telling stories about our past is a political exercise. It's not a historical one. It's meant to demonstrate to others what hopes we want to embrace and which ones we want to forego, right? And I think that's as clear as day to me when you see all the books being written on this. Like, you know, the right will publish these books about the founding ideals. Well, they want to revisit this kind of enlightenment liberty, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of the colorblind society, right? And then you get the left coming out with history books saying, no, we're not, we don't want to highlight that. We want to highlight this. But these are political statements. They're not necessarily historical, and they're certainly not objective in the strong sense of the word.
Absolutely. It's been a little over a decade since Rorty passed. Imagine Rorty's with us right now, and he's wanting to present a story or a mythology to us of what America is. What is that story? What is the imagery he wants us to have of America?
I think that story is one that says, hey, we've done a lot of bad stuff, a lot of bad stuff, but we are not irredeemable. We are not beyond redemption. And I think that's honestly, that's the take home point for him. He, you know, he's citing authors like James Baldwin, he uses, and people sometimes push back on his interpretation of Baldwin, but that's a whole nother story. You know, Rorty and the interpreting of thinkers, but
of everyone,
of everyone. Exactly. But you know, he uses Baldwin. He says Baldwin thought this country was a mess. Baldwin moved to Paris. He moved to Turkey or wherever. You know, he got away from this because he thought it was so despicable, but he kept writing, right? And by Rorty's telling, you know, he didn't give up hope. He was still trying to fundamentally change the character of this country. And notably, he was trying to root out the white supremacism he saw in the South, but also in the North, for that matter, that people often forget about. But he didn't think it was beyond redemption. And I think that's the story Rorty would still emphasize today. I honestly don't think much has changed since he wrote that book. If that's, I know you didn't ask me that question, but I don't think much has changed. Mind. Yeah. So yeah, I and maybe that's a cynical reading. I just think things have gotten even more cynical, certainly on the left, and more fractured. And by more fractured, I think there's kind of the flip side of that, which I think is there's been more purity testing, things of that nature. Like, you know, you got to hit check all these boxes. And these things are fine, but they're not good for what Rorty's point was, which was coalition building. Right? Building a strong Democratic Party or just a leftist party that can actually make change. Politics for him isn't something that's supposed to instantiate your personal beliefs to a T, to a letter, you know, dot all your I's and cross all your T's. That's not what he thought politics was. He thought it was something where you make compromises. And this is his story, you know, about, I know you said we'd get to it, the pre-60s left, what he refers to as the first half of the century and the social democratic left. I mean, they were making compromises and unseemly compromises all over the place. And, you know, to make sure that certain laws were passed. So, and I think people do not see, you know, you see this phenomenon today. People will not make compromises. People will not make deals with institutions or people who, even over slight disagreements with respect to what have you. So, yeah, I mean, I guess, again, you didn't really ask that question, but it's obviously where that question kind of naturally leads.
Yeah, let's go down that path a little bit. Let's explain a little bit more clearly what Rorty means by the reformist left, the time period basically preceding the 1960s, as it contrasts with the cultural left, the more predominant left that has been around since then. What are the distinctions there?
Yeah, I mean, we touched a little bit on these already, but the pre-60s left he refers to as a genuine social democratic left this country had were the people interested in changing institutions, actually passing laws, putting up policies and changing policies and rolling back laws that were, you know, racist or whatever, actually interested in changing the institutions of this country. That's probably the simplest way you could put it. People actively engaged in politics. I mean, that's quite literally all there is to what he thinks about. And it's a dirty game. It's a tough game to be involved in politics. You sometimes have to sell your soul, you know, with respect to one issue and to get progress on another issue. And I think he would say in one sense, that's regrettable, but in another sense, that's just kind of the way it is living in a pluralistic and diverse society. Contrast that with, as I said in the beginning, and we talked about in the beginning with, you know, Vietnam and Watergate started to make people extremely cynical. Vietnam foreign relations internationally and Watergate domestically. I mean, that just is like the perfect storm, all that happening at the same time. And people thought maybe this country isn't all that it's cracked up to be, like you're saying. And so they kind of sit on the sidelines, Marty said, and they kind of retreat to, I hesitate to say this because I know this brings up all kinds of things, but they kind of retreat to theory. They kind of retreat to philosophy and in their academic subdisciplines to work problems out that actually, I don't know, this is incredibly contentious. They're working out problems that actually don't help anybody's lives, right? And I think he would stick by that claim today. I mean, I think he would say, you can do that stuff. You know, in your ivory tower, you can talk about all these fancy new, you know, all this new academic jargon, respect to race and gender and all that good stuff. But don't kid yourself that it's actually helping people on the ground. Don't kid yourself that it's actually helping people pass policies and laws that make people's lives substantially better. And yeah, I think he sees this post-60s left as just a total retreat into that kind of attitude and a fracturing of the disciplines in a sense, too.
Yeah, Rorty's definitely makes this point. He uses the language of this more activist left versus a more spectating or spectatorial left, where that's where you're getting at that point, I think, of the theorizing of we're just going to retreat, we're going to be cynical, have this sort of self-loathing of what it means to be an American and burn
and that feels good
down.
And that feels good, too, right? I mean, you feel, I mean, truly, when you back up and you don't have to get your hands dirty and you're theorizing from afar saying, well, if they only listen to me or whatever, right? And, oh, no, well, this is the problem. Look at the laundry list of problems. Is it even worth, you know, diving in and trying to fix? I mean, I think that to a certain extent is preferable to the alternative, which is getting your hands dirty and seeing very little progress, right, for all the work you're putting in. And I think that's kind of the part of the difference I think he's trying to bring out. But I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
No, you're fine. That I think that's exactly right. There is, for a lot of us, and in talking with some people about some of Rorty's thought, I've heard this feeling of it feels good in a way of I think it's easy to slip into a sort of smugness of, well, I know this is how things are, but we're fated. The inherent nature of America is such that it's been a racist country, always will be. It will always be unjust toward all sorts of marginalized groups. But I'm going to theorize as to why and wait until you join my side and agree with me. But what am I then doing to actually change that? What are specific laws? And later on in the book, Rorty gets to talking about distinctions between campaigns and movements and actually making change. So I want to dip our toes in a little bit into where Rorty gets a bit more into the philosophy and his critiques of metaphysics, specifically correspondence theory of truth in here. So Rorty, as a philosopher, he's really disinterested in truth, or at least, like I said, rejects the correspondence theory of truth. He channels John Dewey and he says, don't think of us as having a mind or having ideas in our heads. Think of us as organisms trying to cope with our environment. We use language and linguistic behavior and social communication for tools for coping with our environment. And the question to be asked about any given belief is it going to help us cope with our environment? In what ways does Rorty's pragmatist views here inform his politics?
That's a large question. but I think you're right in seeing that his metaphysical beliefs or anti-metaphysical beliefs and his larger philosophy, I think that's part of the really does connect up with his politics. And I think that's part of the reason why he wrote this book, which surprised people when he published it, to be honest with you, which is kind of interesting. He just shocked people. It's like, oh, like this big time philosopher just came out this book out of nowhere and it's like highly readable and accessible. But in any event, so I think you're right in pointing out that connection there. And what I think he's getting at is he's saying, look, I think we've gotten to the point in society where we can just be accountable to each other, and we can kind of just bring ourselves off this pedestal. With respect to the metaphysical beliefs, he's basically saying, let's not think of ourselves accountable to anything other than each other. And that could be God, that could be the science. And when he's talking about the correspondence theory of belief, that could be the world, which is what kind of you were referring to there. So he's saying, you know, the world doesn't speak to us. It doesn't say anything. And famously in a passage, he says, when the world starts speaking to us, when God starts speaking to us, then we can converse with them, but they don't. So why do we feel like we're always kind of displeasing what the world is saying out there? And I think part of his political project here is just to say, look, we're only accountable to each other. There's no other authority save the authority of human beings coming together and agreeing about something. And that's an extremely radical belief. I don't know if that's clear, but it takes the divinity out of everything, out of every kind of corner of, or the magic or the metaphysics out of any. There's nothing that holds power over us as human beings other than ourselves. And when he's talking about language just being tools, that's what he means. Language doesn't reflect anything. We're not trying to reflect what the world looks like out there with language. We're actually just trying to cope with our environment. And the way we can cope with other people are involved in our environment too. And they're using language as tools too. So it's just a very, to put it very briefly, it's a totally naturalized view of human interaction and the world we live in all the way through, right? And that's a very radical view because people like the ideas of truth, right? And justice and these overriding kind of principles. And we're supposed to kind of bow down to these things, or even the science. I mean, he's going to famously say science is on all fours with literature and poetry, right? This is not some master discipline either, which is, right? He's carrying his, you know, anti-metaphysics, anti-essentialism, right? All the way through. He's being consistent here. He's not, you know, and most people would say, oh, typical lefty, probably, like, he thinks we should, you know, follow the science. Not really. He has some choice words about science too, and he's just being consistent across the board, which is kind of.
So if Rorty is basically saying we're not beholden to non-human authorities, meaning we're not judging things according to the, what Kant might say, like the moral law within or God's will or some abstract a priori notion of reason, mm-hmm. what are the standards or how do we judge social progress? How are we supposed to, as citizens in a democracy, supposed to know we are doing good or making progress?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And this is one I actually struggle with myself, because with Rorty's philosophy and his politics, you actually are left really uncertain as to what kind of anchors you in society. His whole thing about progress is let's make the future better than the past, right? I mean, that's basically, let's hope for a future is what we should be worried about. That's about as metaphysical as he's going to get. How can we be sure we're making progress? I think he would just say point blankly, we don't, right? We can make, all we could ever do is just listen to each other. If someone thinks we made progress and someone else doesn't, that entails a conversation. And this is part of my own interpretation of Rorty, I think. I think people have missed, or at least people who take Rorty seriously, have missed the radical democratic kind of conversational politics that this implies. Like, there is nothing left to do but talk to our fellow citizens after Rorty. There is nothing left. And I guess my point in saying that is that the very idea of whether we made progress is up for democratic deliberation for him, because there's nothing else we could point to besides, if 80% of the country thinks we make progress, I guess we made progress. Like, he's willing to say, you can disagree and you can have your disagreements, but that's it. There's nothing else. There's nothing where we can say, oh, well, everyone else is delusional, or that one person is delusional, or that segment of the society is delusional, because saying that stuff just, it evades the responsibility we have to each other, right? It's like an easy way out, if that makes sense. So to answer your question, I just don't think he would try and say, tell a story about how progress is simply being better than we were in the past. But I think by not expanding on that, as he really didn't as much, he kind of left that up open for interpretation. He's just saying, look around. Are we better than we were in the 1860s? Yes. Look, there's your progress, right? So people who argue against, you know, the way we never make progress kind of stuff, he's just going to take this like very commonsensical view of the matter. And it's always up for debate. And I don't know if that's a satisfying answer, but that's kind of the his consistent anti-authoritarianism running through all his ideas.
It's definitely a struggle, even for those who are sympathetic or might be sympathetic to Rorty, is trying to grasp for that, something to ground it in. And we always, I think there's a strong desire for that sense of truth, of something that grounds and anchors and secures. For me, digging through Rorty, I found there's a quote in which he's channeling Whitman and Dewey and saying they wanted utopian America to replace God as that unconditional object of desire. They wanted the struggle for social justice to be the country's animating principle, the nation's soul. And so it seems that seems to be ultimately for Rorty the closest he gets to grounding what progress might look like, is saying, hey, if we're diminishing suffering and reducing shame and what he refers specifically as the political sadism, that's progress. But that's also going to be talked about different narratives as to what that looks like. And all we can really do is say, here's a vision, here's the story of that vision. Let's move toward that.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. I'm glad you added that last bit too, because about the competing narratives, because what social justice looks like to the right in this country is certainly not what social justice looks like to the left. And that's not to say, it's not a commentary on either one being, you know, better or worse necessarily. It's just the plain fact of the matter is he's going to say, like, that's the overriding goal. But the thing to notice about when he's saying he wants to replace God as the object of devotion to social justice, that's thoroughly humanized, right? That's still talking about humans. And that's the important take-home point for Rorty. He's just bringing everything back down to the human level. All we have, he says at one point, is each other clinging against the dark in a very kind of poetic way. And that hits me, you know, and that hits a lot of readers. That's all we have. It's unnerving, but at the same time, it's liberating, which I think reading Rorty and readers of Rorty kind of feel that same thing. Like, oh, he's talking about truth. Truth is just what we all agree upon, right? What your peers let you get away with saying, which he later said was a silly way of putting it. But yeah, I think you're exactly right about that. And I think it's both liberating to people who kind of tend towards his attitude on thing, and it's very scary to people who are not familiar with that way of thinking. And politics is tough too.
You touched a point here on Rorty's secularism. And I know Rorty's wife, for example, in an interview about him, mentioned that he probably wouldn't be quite as comfortable with being labeled as an atheist as much as being anti-clerical, which ties into his anti-authoritarianism as manifest in religion. So I'm wondering what, for those who otherwise might be sympathetic to what Rorty is saying and his maybe shared political goals, when he's talking about democracy being a new conception of what it is to be human, you know, a conception which has no room for obedience to non-human authority, and in which nothing save freely achieved consensus among human beings has any authority at all, where does that leave room for the religious in America to join in? Are they sidelined? How is a religious person, broadly understood, supposed to take Rorty at this point?
Oh, this is a tough one. Partly tough because I think most people won't like the answer. Rorty is squarely, so as you said, he's anti, he moved late in his later life, called himself an atheist early on, and then he moved to anti-clericalism, which is, of course, being against hierarchical institutions and organized religion. You know, when people say, oh, I don't, it's kind of the cliche, I don't not like religion, I don't like organized religion, which, you know, to a certain extent is kind of what Rorty's getting at here. One of the last things he wrote on the subject with a long time friend of his, Jeffrey Stout, who's a professor of religion, he basically says, look, the long-term goal here is a fully secularized society and no religion. He says that point blank in the last year that he was alive. And then he also says, but given that that probably won't be true for a couple centuries, thousands of years, maybe even, there is a pragmatic aspect which says we're going to have religious people with us, so we should probably try and build coalitions and basically liberalize religious people out of their religious beliefs. I mean, it's pretty rough when he says this. Basically, just we should try and teach fundamentalists. He's talking about fundamentalist religious people here. We want to get them out of that fundamentalist religion, and we want to make them more liberal. And the way he bridges this divide between saying, look, the long-term goal is atheism for everybody, but the short-term goal is saying, look, you can have your religion in private. You know, it's the Jeffersonian compromise, right? You can have religion, but keep it out of politics, sort of thing. And that doesn't really hold necessarily, because obviously a lot of people criticize that, like, oh, I'm a true believer. You're telling me I can't bring my beliefs into the public sphere. But Rorty held fast to this. He didn't really care about the contradictions because he had the long-term goal in mind. That said, he was pragmatic. If you needed to build a coalition with your own religious people to get certain things passed, that's fine. I think what he regrets most is the fundamentalist turn in the late 80s, 90s, and today, the evangelical movement. I think that's something he was really, and that which overshadowed Martin Luther King, liberation theology, leftist kind of theology. I mean, people never associate in this country religion with the left, right? Mm-hmm. But the social gospel was, I mean, look at Rorty's grandparents, you know, right? You know, working in politics. Grandfather was a preacher, preached the social gospel. And that's what motivated a lot of people in the early half of the 20th century to get into politics and make people's lives better. And that was completely overshadowed by this new movement. And I think he sees that as a regrettable. I know that's probably contentious too, but
I'm wanting to connect here. There's several threads that Rorty holds in his hand that he's piecing together, which are correspondence theory of truth, rejecting that, his rejection of authoritarianism, trying to present in a Deweyan fashion democracy as a sort of secular religion. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to connect it with this quote. Rorty's friend, Gianni Vattimo, who's also a philosopher from a Catholic tradition,
yes,
wrote a book to a similar effect. And I want to read it to you, get your reaction to it. And this is in A Farewell to Truth. Vattimo writes, "Not all metaphysicians have been violent, but I would say that almost all large-scale perpetrators of violence have been metaphysicians. If Hitler had merely hated the Jews in his neighborhood, he would have set fire to their houses and that would have been it. But he worked up a general theory to the effect that they were an inferior race and that it would be better to eliminate them completely. In other words, he reached the point of holding a theory that he believed to be true." I'm wondering, how strong of a case does Rorty make for jettisoning the notion of corresponding truth in the name of democracy and minimizing human suffering? And second to that, I would ask, would Rorty say that there's a tendency for those who embrace correspondence theories of truth to tend toward authoritarianism?
The latter question, I think he would say yes, but he was severely criticized for that kind of point. I would say it's more or less look around kind of thing, like kind of take your own approach to it, you know, talk to people and see if they're kind of it's weird to say correspondence theory of talk, but when they talk about essentialism and non-human authorities, as you put it, are they more apt to not really care about not necessarily the suffering of their, but what they're fellow human beings are saying? And I think Rorty would say something like, I think they have stories in their head that allowed them to evade the actual emotions and feelings and empathizing with those people, right? They have, like you said, they have these stories, or as Vadimo said, about whipping up stories that they thought to be true. I don't know how to address that one in particular, that quote, just because Rorty's problem with religion is the classic atheist one, where he says, I believe on the whole religion has been more harmful, and religious institutions in particular, than good. And so this is a stalemate. There is no, this debate is still happening today, and I just don't think you can solve it. But that was his hunch, and you know, people like Jeffrey Stout and people who criticized him, Christian philosophers and other religious philosophers, basically said, well, no, I think that's been better good because of, you know, people's personal salvation, people's personal beliefs. And so I don't think you can get past this. He does think that this obedience to a non-human authority does tend towards people being more essentialist, absolutistic, and stuff like that. And I think that's why he wanted a pragmatist culture. I'd be curious how the Vadimo quote ties into that.
So with that, I was connecting it to there are places in which Rorty says that his anti-authoritarianism is the motive behind John Dewey's opposition to Platonic and other theocentric metaphysics, and behind his more original, far more controversial opposition to the correspondence theory of truth. So Rorty seems to make that connection of, if you adhere to the correspondence theory of truth, there's also a good likelihood you're going to have more authoritarian manifestations in your politics, which Rorty's very opposed to, and is trying to say, hey, we need to democratize everything. That means the way we make decisions about how society is ordered. We need to democratize the way we even engage with our notions of truth and the environment. He's trying to piece this all together. And I think in what could be a rhetorically powerful, but also very controversial thing to say, well, if you want these same goals that I have, you may also need to adhere to these other things that I'm challenging. And it is very controversial. I'm just trying to really paint that in stark terms, because it is a very radical quote. And when I've discussed it with people, it hits very uncomfortably when you say, oh, well, if you hold the metaphysics, you might be violent at some point. You're like, whoa, 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 hold on, buddy.
I think Rorty would probably express sympathy with that. I mean, there's a lot of those kind of quotes that really run against the grain of our common sense. Like, you know, the first thing a principle does is kill somebody. Stuff like that, where it's like this allegiance to theories, like you said, when you brought up Hitler, to like a theory in your head, you know, to something else. Your allegiance to everything but your fellow humans is what is responsible for so much suffering. And I think that's Rorty's point. I think that's Vadimo's point, which he agreed with Vadimo about religion. I mean, he more or less says, and he got more attracted to religion later in his life as some of his critics pressed him on it. But I think Jeffrey Stout, who I mentioned earlier, and Vadimo kind of convinced him that, look, there's people who, you know, religious people and religious believers who don't think, you know, like what you're kind of painting them as, kind of these authoritarian people. And Rorty said, okay, so much the better for them then, right? Like, we can have more of those people. That's fine. That's not who I'm talking about. I think that's more or less his approach there, which I tend to, you know, he'll probably just say, okay, well, they're good liberals. Like, if they're religious people who care about the suffering of others, then like, so be it. You know, like Stout accused him of essentializing religion. Rorty's like, oh, well, religion is on the whole bad. And Stout's like, well, you're an anti-essentialist, so how could you say that? And so Rorty, you know, kind of had to rethink his rhetorical strategy on that one, you know, and Stout had kind of had a point there, but insofar as it went, I think you're right to point out that that's a really dominant strain there. And it just captures all of his philosophy. And like you said, it's truly radical, and it's mind-bending sometimes and unnerving kind of. Yeah, his religion, his thoughts on religion were scattershot very early on, and he never really came to a final conclusion other than short term, that's fine. Just let's all try and be good liberals. Long term, let's try and... He said something, the last thing I'll note, because it usually ruffles people's feathers. He says, you know, when he has evangelical students come to him, he's going to try and get them out of their evangelicalism. And he just says this in an essay. And a lot of conservatives at the time when he wrote this were like, look what the leftists are saying. They're trying to educate our kids out of religion. And Rorty's like, yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. Like, why would I not own up? Why would I not own up to the thick ethical principles that liberalism implies, right? Like, why do you want me to be this person who's fully tolerant of everybody if I, you know, right? You know, and that's a whole nother track we don't need to go down, but it's definitely consistent with his views. So
let's riff a little on his notions of religion. I know it's a very tired trope of writing for folks to take an idea or a group of people they disagree with, and then to say, oh, look how religious this group is, as a sort of a knock on them. Of it's reminiscent of the militant atheism that you referenced at the beginning of the episode. But Rorty talks about how it seemed the left has become quasi-religious, particularly around the concept of original sin. And this is something he's specifically talking about, the cultural left, where they've seemed to have held on to this notion America was conceived in this original sin it will never be redeemed from. He says that it reinvented the old religious idea that some stains are ineradicable. This left has gotten something which is entirely too much like religion, for the cultural left has come to believe that we must place our country within a theoretical frame of reference, situate it within a vast quasi-cosmological perspective. Is Rorty off the mark here? Or has the cultural left really taken on some unproductive quasi-religious elements, do you think?
Yeah, this kind of harkens back to what I said. You know, it's a good reference to Damn the Absolute here, because what he's talking about in that kind of cosmological narrative is just shying away from those huge narratives in general about our country, and goes back to the 1619 project in a sense. But I would agree with this, and this is part of what makes it hard to talk about Rorty, is because I don't know if you said this earlier, but you said, you know, it's crazy, you know, he was kind of on the left and admired by people on the left, and it's actually not true. I don't know if you said that, but I thought you said something like that. But he writes in his autobiography that the left and the right equally hated him. I mean, the right hated him because they thought he was a radical leftist, you know, trying to educate their kids out of religion. And the left hated him because they thought he's taking his thoughts from kind of this reformist left, which tried to make compromises. They're about piecemeal and incremental change. And the radical left is like, okay, no, you're about the status quo. We don't like you either. So I guess what my point with saying that is, it is hard to talk about this because right now it does seem that criticism of the left is met with, and I'm going to be very, very, very hesitant here, with almost a religious-like fervor that you would see in more absolutist and essentialist and authoritarian attitudes, not cultures, just like an attitude, like having an authoritarian attitude with like very little flexibility. I'm not trying to say like the left is authoritarian. And I think this is what makes it hard to talk about this, because Rorty was like so critical of the left. And I truly don't think that his themes were picked up or his ideas were mauled over. I think we've just bowled over Rorty and just kept on down the path of, look, the left is going to eat its own. We're going to be splintered into a million different things, and it's going to be impossible to build a coalition. I mean, look at not to be, you know, too contemporary, but look at, you know, the Bernie Sanders movement. Look at Bernie versus Warren this time. Look at Bernie versus Clinton last. I mean, it's a mess. And there's people who say, okay, well, if I can't have this person, then you're not getting my, I don't know what to do about that. And I don't think there's any, like, I don't pretend to have all the answers, but that's sort of what Rorty's talking about here, is you're not going to get anywhere with that kind of stuff. To add on to your point about kind of the religious qualities, it's more of like, we're going back to what he talked about, you know, the Marxist, the purity of the Marxist, right? You know, anybody who wasn't a Marxist was cast out of the theoretical frame of reference or our politics. And he's like, that's purity isn't good for politics. And yeah, I don't know if that answers your question either, but I think that's sort of what he was talking about when he said that the left has acquired these quasi-religious but this goes back to everybody's quasi-religious, right? I mean, this is, to Rorty's point, we're not a pragmatist culture at this point. I mean, how many people are fallibists walking around like that? How many people are anti-skeptics, right? How many people acknowledge that we're embedded beings in a, you know, a web of meanings that we didn't create? I don't think anybody's really like that. So we're all kind of quasi-religious, and his effort was to try and wedge us, you know, out of that. And I'm not sure he was necessarily successful.
I want to give Rorty, or have you give Rorty, a chance to build some bridges with his friends on the left, because he does offer praise to the cultural left as he talks about them.
That's a great.
He's trying to build coalition. So, what are some of the praises that he's offering to those from the 1960s onward on the left.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point to bring up too, and I'm glad you did, because right now it sounds like he's just a critic. But it, you know, in Achieving Our Country, he basically says, look, the 60s cultural left did amazing work in reducing stigma, right? Of getting, you know, this is what the right referred to as being politically correct, you know, not, you know, racial slurs, you know, all these things that I won't name. I mean, to get stigma out of all these from minorities out of our everyday political conversation, he said, we largely have to thank the radical kind of 60s cultural, when they're talking about language and the ways that power works, it seeps its way into language and produces the status quo, right? Just in the simple languages and words we used to uphold those kind of, you know, whether it be the patriarchy or racism, right? Things we are so unthinking to the culture that we, you know, never even stop to think, well, is this harmful to someone's, you know, identity? He says the 60s left is, or the post-60s left, sorry, is almost wholly responsible for bringing to light those things and making a cultural change. I mean, that's, I assume that's what you're kind of getting at here.
That's one of the strong points he's making, is saying, look, brings up 2 points of addressing stigma. And what he talks about, the other aspect of the left is being united around challenging greed, as he sees it, the inequalities. And a lot of those achievements would not have happened unless those on the left were a bit more radical and revolutionary and challenging what has been, as you put it, some critics on the left of saying, oh, well, that's just PC culture. And he said, no, this matters. And this has made a big difference in a lot of marginalized communities' lives.
Yeah.
And we should applaud the cultural left for that.
Absolutely. And he's, and like you said, his point is, look, the reformist left had a lot of issues. Did they, right? I mean, it was mostly white men doing these reforms, right? And so they mostly left out all these other, you know, all these minorities from the conversation. And it was mostly white men who were the beneficiaries of some of these things. So, or this progress, I guess you could call it. But everything else was, you know, there was still nastiness. There was this, you know, homophobia was rampant, right? And that's what he's talking about. So while the reformist left had all these strides, you know, institutionally, or at least they tried, they still had this undercurrent of just nastiness. Now, switch to the other side, right? The post-60s, and they said, well, they got rid of a lot of those stigmas and they helped bring light to all these things that were previously brushed under the rug. They sort of let up the reins on the institutional side, the institutional reform. And so at the end of this book, he basically says, look, at the end of the day, 100 years from now, we're all going to look at all these people as part of the same leftist effort, right? We're going to look at the labor organizers right alongside the people who are urging us to stop using the N-word or slurs for gay people, right? Like all these people are going to be considered part of the same movement, right? And so and that's kind of his point. It's like, no, let's bring it back together, because even today you have a disdain of the left for this kind of reformist attitude, right? This kind of incrementalism, you still see it today. So I don't think Rorty's wholly off the mark. And you can see this, see it in the history since probably the 70s and 80s of the country. Maybe this is a little more tendentious, moving right, right? Because of the masterful storytelling and narratives that the right have put out in the airwaves and the fracturing of the left. And I know that's a more tendentious claim. I don't know where you stand on that, but I don't think we've gone like radically right, but we certainly have made strides in that direction, much to the probably disagreement of people on Fox News who think we're a radical left country. I don't know. I mean, it's dizzying to even enter that conversation, but yeah, and I think that's the point of the book. We're all going to be leftists. So let's just call it what it is. The reformist left has its huge blind spots. The cultural left has its huge blind spots. Let's try and hold both of these reins in the hand at the same time. I mean, he literally says that at one point. He says, it seems like the left couldn't do more than one thing at the same time. They could either reform policies or worry about stigma, and they couldn't do them both. But he says, we have to.
I appreciate that he's highlighting blind spots and strengths, as well as acknowledging, in his view, and again, this is maybe a contentious point, as there really hasn't been that much change politically from the left since basically the 60s. But I want to close out here, and this is something that Rorty's book Achieving Our Country, I think in part why it's had a bit of a revival the last few years, has been what to me reads as a very prophetic analysis from Rorty near the 85 to 90th page in his book. And you've seen quotes on this since the 2016 election and drawing these parallels. And I was actually, last night, I was actually reading this to someone. I sat them down and forced them to sit and hear me read every single word of four pages of this. It was, yes, so kind. And I just was in awe of it. I was wondering, so Rorty talks about this, and this, again, this is written 20 years ago, and he talks about how globalization, rising inequality, stagnating social mobility, and talks about this theorizing cultural left is going to lead to the rise of, quote, a strong man. I was wondering if you could briefly walk us through, quote unquote, the prophetic Rorty and what he articulates there.
Yeah, that quote is great. And yeah, you're right. It was right in the wake of the election of Trump. People were, you know, throwing that quote around all over the place, all over the internet. But he basically says, if we continue down this track of kind of the left retreating from politics, of the left kind of fracturing, the left solely focusing, and this is, again, I know this is all requires, you know, hours worth of conversation to unpack, but in a typical Rorty fashion, I'll just put it out there. So So if we continue to focus on these extremely myopic philosophical views about race and gender, right, and continue to do that, that kind of fractures the left into more pieces. He says, I think, quote, something is going to crack. Right. And he basically says an authoritarian strong man's going to come in. Racial slurs are going to come back into fashion. Jocular contempt of women is going to come back into fashion. And all the things that the 60s left really worked so hard to get rid of, all that stigma is going to come back into fashion. Now, if there's not a more prophetic statement than that in the wake of 2016, I'm not sure if anybody's found one, but I assume that's what you're talking about here. Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. But I think part of that story is, and he says this in a couple of interviews he does, and I know this is part of the part that's uncomfortable for people to hear, I think, in part, but it harkens back to his ideas about this reformist left. He says, look, if we need to talk, and this is going to sound like this is what is going to garner sighs from people, we need to talk about class again. And I know that's a huge topic right now. It's a huge topic for debate, but we need to talk about broader groups of people. The idea that, and this is going to sound, again, contentious, the idea that the white working class doesn't really matter is a problem, right? And it's going to continue to be a problem. If it's not a priority, it needs to be one column in the Democratic or the leftist or the liberal plank. Right. It has to be. And I think that's part of Rorty's point in saying something's going to crack. As soon as you start not, you know, forgetting about whole swaths of people in this country whose lives, and I'm not going to say we're not going to play this game where, you know, their life is worse than others, but let's be honest, there's plenty of people, black, white, brown, whatever, who are not doing well, right? Mm-hmm. As soon as you start drawing circles around these groups of people and ordering things, that's fine, but it's terrible for politics. You can have all that, but if you can't build those coalitions, something's going to crack. A strong man's going to come in and start making promises to people who have been drawn out of these circles, and all that progress he made is going to be undone. I mean, that's basically what he says in that kind of prophetic statement. I don't know if that was clear, but yeah, I mean, that's, and I don't know. I think there's, insofar as that quote got bandied about after the election, I think that's fine. But I wish it had led people to read more Rorty rather than just say it was more of like, look, you guys, this is what happened. We fell for it. Well, yeah, but also maybe you should look deeper into what Rorty was saying in this book and other places and try and prevent the next time, you know, something like this happening.
Is one of the really insightful things that jumps out to me here is, If we look at America broadly understanding, you can look at a whole host of different polls where it seems the average American is left of center on a lot of economic policies. Mm. And with a lot of these more like cultural issues that the quote unquote cultural left is trying to reduce stigma, a lot of Americans are a little bit more right of center on that and tired of what they might consider the division and the distraction. And Rorty in this prophetic section talks about how the super rich elites are going to continue going about their business, right? While those flames are going about because they'll be fine. And so I think we see that as this populism. And it's interesting because there are some outlets and forces actually I've noticed on the right who are joining this coalition of saying, hey, what does a conservative union sort of push for unions from a conservative perspective look like? We need to maybe look more at class distinction. So I think that's one thing that Rorty highlights that I personally would love to see a little bit more conversation on. Any final last thoughts on Rorty? What can we do going forward?
One thing I think we can do is pick up Achieving Our Country. I think, as you would agree, it's an easy, accessible read for non-philosophers and philosophers alike. I think he has a knack for making things extremely accessible. He's very persuasive. But what we can do politically is, I'm so worried about the fracturing of the left. I love the diversity on the left, and I don't mean diversity like the typical diversity buzzword. I mean just like so many different views, right? And I love that, and we're constantly criticizing each other, but we and making our views better, and we're dialoguing and conversing. But I think we let that get in the way of building effective political coalitions. I think there's two different projects there, and one is kind of a hearts and minds project of cultural politics, and the other one is more of a institutional and political reform project that I think we need to be able to hold two of those things, if not in tension, at least slide back and forth of them between them, so that we can, you know, help people materially and also spiritually. So yeah, that's my one. I guess it's kind of a depressing outlook, but I don't know if we could do that. I don't know if we're going to do that, especially, you know, with Biden and what people are saying about Biden. And I don't know. I'm like Rorty quoted I forget who he quotes on this, but he says pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will, which accurately reflects how I feel about things at this moment in time. I'm pretty pessimistic when I think about things, but I have no choice but to, as he said, just hope for a better future and keep working at it.
Well, we've given Rorty a little bit of time to shine, to maybe knock Rorty down a peg or two. Who do you think is perhaps one of his greatest critics, particularly in regards to his political philosophy, or even more broadly, his philosophy in general?
Who do I think is one of his critics? I do think, as I mentioned, Jeffrey Stout is a great interlocutor with him with respect to religion and politics. I think he definitely modified his views. This is more academic, but Bjorn Ramberg is a philosopher who was very close with Rorty throughout his life too. If anybody has a chance to pick up Rorty and His Critics, it's a great volume. Some big name philosophers in there, Daniel Dennett, Dowell's in that, but basically taking him to task on all these things. And Ramberg has a criticism in there of Rorty that's pretty powerful, of his philosophy about representation, correspondence theory, and triangulation, and all this good academic stuff that doesn't matter to politics. But I think he has a very solid criticism of Rorty, and Rorty took it in stride, and in that very same volume sort of just says, yeah, you're absolutely right, and sort of modified his views later on. Critics, I mean, there's just so many of them. I think a lot of there were, I mean, as you know, throughout his life, because he just was not looked upon. He was cited widely, but not looked upon favorably. Gary Gutting has a solid book out called Pragmatic Liberalism. He's got where he tackles Rorty and McIntyre and Charles Taylor, and his chapter on Rorty is excellent in terms of really critiquing his views and adjusting them for his own purposes. I really like that book. So I'll stop there. All those are pretty good sources. Well, I guess I will say one more thing. A lot of the criticism flung at Rorty was disingenuous. I know that's probably not a good thing to end on, because people are like, oh, of course, you know, like your favorite philosopher and everybody else was getting him wrong.
Well, misunderstood.
Yeah, exactly. Misunderstood. But honest to God, there are a wealth of legitimate criticisms you can level against him. I just think a lot of it was surrounded by, or a lot of the criticism of Rorty was due to his flamboyant language, his turns of phrase, his rhetorical style, rather than what he was saying, right? Truth is what your peers let you get away with saying. Okay, this is just a turn of phrase that he thought was catchy and flashy, and it was, and it caught attention, and people have been criticizing him for that for 35 years. So I just encourage people to look past, you know, some of that rhetorical flair and get into the substance, and you'll find that his ideas are really worthwhile to wrestle with, even if they are at the end of the day not somewhat your cup of tea.
We'll leave those in the show notes for folks to read. Otherwise, Adrian, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for listening to Damn the Absolute. I hope you found our conversation worthwhile. We would love it if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that is Stitcher, iTunes, CastBox, or one of the many other options available to you. It goes a long way in helping us to build a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you next time.